I will now call upon our past chair, Dr. Robin Taylor Wilson, to introduce the Wade Hampton Frost Lecture.
Good afternoon. It's a delight to be here. It's so nice to see everyone. Thank you so much for coming. It is my honor and privilege to introduce this year's Wade Hampton Frost Lectureship Award winner, Dr. Jonathan M. Samet. Dr. Samet is a pulmonary physician and epidemiologist, and last month became the dean of the School of Public Health in Colorado. He was previously the distinguished professor and Flora L. Thornton chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California, and director of the USC Institute for Global Health. Dr. Samet received his bachelor's degree in chemistry and physics from Harvard College, an MD degree from the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry, and a Master of Science degree in epidemiology from the Harvard School of Public Health. His research has focused on health risks of inhaled pollutants, particles, and ozone in outdoor air and indoor pollutants, including secondhand smoke and radon. He has also investigated the occurrence and causes of cancer and respiratory diseases, emphasizing the risks of active and passive smoking. He has served on numerous committees of the National Research Council and Institute of Medicine. And just so you know, his bio is actually much longer, and he's sort of hatched out some of these things just to make it shorter for us. But suffice it to say, many other wonderful activities that he's participated in. For several decades, he has been involved in global health, focusing on tobacco control, air pollution, and chronic disease prevention. He chaired the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee of the US EPA and chairs the FDA Tobacco Products Scientific Advisory Committee. Dr. Sam has served as editor and author for reports of the Surgeon General on Smoking and Health since 1984, receiving the Surgeon General's Medallion in 1990 and 2006 for these contributions. He was the senior scientific editor for the 50th anniversary 2014 report, and Dr. Samet received the 2004 Prince Mahidol Award for Global Health awarded by the King of Thailand. He's also the Dahl Winder Award from SRNT and the Edward Livingston Trudeau Medal from the American Thoracic Society, American Lung Association, and the 2016 Fries Prize for Health. He was elected to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences in 1997. The other little piece about Dr. Samet, he and I served on the Young Epidemiology Scholar Award. So this is a program Robert Wood Johnson Foundation had a number of years ago, offering college scholarships to students who did really long, amazing projects for high school students who had never learned concepts in epidemiology. Through that process, learned what an outdoorsman that he is, really at any opportunity he gets to, you know, in all your spare time, to get outside, enjoy the outdoors, and, you know, I think really a role model. So without further ado, Dr. Samet, if you'd come forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this honor. I'm delighted to be here to give this presentation and appreciate your recognizing me. The make a few comments. I'm delighted with the company I'm in to be here with Noel. We were reminiscing that we think we started on the Epidemiology and Disease Control Studies section when there was only one in 1982. This involved carrying a very heavy box of grants from wherever you were to Washington. And the most gratifying thing was after you reviewed a grant, you got to throw it into a big trash bin. I've admired the work of Mona, Dr. Mona, and her steadfast performance in the light of the media in using evidence to advance public health. She was just terrific and a model that I held up to students as this was unfolding. To Tyler, if I get through that book, but I'm going to give it a try. I will say, and this is a comment to Tyler and also to Noel, I spoke at the retreat of the Department of Epidemiology at Harvard earlier in the year. I reviewed the curriculum when I was there. There were 8 courses offered by the Department of Epidemiology. 2 of them were practicums, and there were 3 methods courses, including 2 by Olin Yetman, a name that may strike fear in the hearts of some still. So with that, let me turn to my topic, and I'm going to try and go short, because what I'd like to do is have a conversation on what I am what I'm talking about. I have to say a word about Frost, having served in the lineage of chairs of the Department of Epidemiology at Hopkins. This is the faculty circa 1935 or so. I've circled Frost, who was the first academic epidemiologist in the United States, hired on the Hopkins from the Public Health Service, essentially, in 1918. For those of you who know the attributable risk figure, this is Mort Levin, whose 1953 paper described what we would now call population attributable risk. Miriam Braley was the first woman in the Department of Epidemiology, hired by Frost to work on tuberculosis, and an interesting figure in her own right. Now, what I'm going to talk about is not about Donald Trump. So you may be thinking, oh no, he's going to be talking about the new administration. I'm not. I'm going to talk about something that is perhaps heightened in our current political climate and its use of science, but antedates the current administration, and I think is a phenomenon that has been underway for several decades, that those of us who do public health, and perhaps particularly epidemiology, need to know and understand. Now, that said, we think we all know that this administration has not embraced science as a basis for action. I spent quite a bit of time last week on the telephone talking to reporters about the EPA administrator's changes in policy around appointment of scientific advisors to the science advisory board. So this is of concern, and there is as of yet not a White House science advisor. Now, I'm going to begin with sort of how we teach our students about how we think epidemiology makes a difference. Of course, we're overly simplistic and naive. So let's start with that story. And I'll go back to Noel's statement about humble uncertainty. Decision making is driven by the balancing of what we know and what we don't know, along with many, many other things. And that balance is swayed by many different factors. So here I've listed some concepts for you to remember. Evidence, what we know. We think as epidemiologists, that's our purpose, isn't it? We're going to generate evidence. Ignorance, that's what we don't know. And I draw your attention to the wonderful book there by Stuart Feuerstein at Columbia that is about ignorance. It comes from an undergraduate course that he teaches. There's a related book called Failure that says we should learn from our failures. Uncertainty, the consequence of ignorance. It's uncertainty. We don't know, and therefore we are uncertain. And then there's doubt, okay? And doubt can lead to uncertainty, of course, and it can delay action. And the Merchants of Doubt book by Oreskes and Conway is only one of the numerous books that describe the invention of the doubt strategy. And I'll come to that story with the tobacco industry. Now, here I don't want to offend anybody, but Jon Snow did not remove the pump handle. Repeat after me. Jon Snow did not remove the pump handle. And I think this is critical to what I'm going to say. He recommended to the Board of Guardians that the pump handle should be removed, and the Board of Guardians acted. Now, I don't know if anybody's read the Cobra event. It's not a great mystery, but I sort of liked his simplification of the story of Jon Snow and the pump handle, and that he removed the handle, and that's the story of epidemiology. Really, there's this paradigmatic clash between miasma and the idea that waterborne disease transmission could occur, even though, of course, the Colibri Vibrio organism was not yet described. That was to come. For those of you wanting a good account, read The Death, The Ghost Map by Johnson, which I've used in an undergrad class for years, and it's a very nice telling of this story. And this is important because what I'm going to describe is what I'm going to call the John Snow model, and the idea that, in fact, there was a cholera epidemic going on. He investigated the Broad Street pump with the ghost map and of course, other work that he did later on cholera in London. He inferred that water transmitted cholera and that the pump handle should be removed. And then, of course, he continued tracking. The epidemic was already abating about this time. And turned to modern public health and the role of epidemiology. We identify problems. We gather data. We analyze and interpret the evidence, often directed at causation. And we translate from evidence to action and then carry out surveillance. So if the world would only work that way, we would gather evidence and things would happen. Maybe sometimes it does. Perhaps in Flint, the evidence was overwhelming. And sometimes with acute outbreaks, that is the case. With our slower epidemics that perhaps so often take so many lives prematurely, we don't act so quickly. And the evidence often needs to pile up. So, you know, if I were a teenager, I would just say that, not. And the world is much more challenging. Now, part of the challenge has been the creation of doubt. And I do think we should give the tobacco industry credit for this. Some of you may have seen what is called the Frank Statement, published in most newspapers and periodicals in the United States in 1954. It has a little trial exhibit because this has appeared in many courtrooms. And it was from this point that we can document, through the industry's own documents, its campaign of fraud and misleading the public. If you've not read Robert Proctor, the Stanford historian's book, chronicling this story from the industry's own documents, read it. It's good. He's angry. He tells a good story. Now, in fact, the doubt creation can be traced to a meeting of the tobacco industry lawyers and executives held at the Park Plaza in 1953, now nicely documented again by our ability to use the industry's documents to get at this story. They realized then, as you will see, that doubt is their product. And it was this creation of doubt that led to the Department of Justice decision by Judge Gladys Kessler in 2006. Again, you might put on your reading list the Kessler opinion, all 1,500 or 1,700 pages of it. It's remarkably articulate, in fact, and storytelling. So, and soon we will have, and finally, the corrective statements to be made by the industry, undoing now, decades later, the lies that they told to the public. And their realization there, this is a well-known quote, "Doubt is our product since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the mind of the general public." Now, I'm going to tell you just one example of the creation of doubt. Perhaps one of the most significant societal changes around tobacco came with the conclusion from the 1986 Surgeon General's reports and other documents that secondhand smoke caused lung cancer in non-smokers. And here is the first conclusion of that report. The third conclusion says, simply separating smokers and non-smokers in the same airspace does not protect. Putting a line down the middle does not protect. I just came from Rome yesterday. Here's an age-related question. How many have been on an airplane where there was smoking? And you ask that, and then younger people will look at you with surprise. There was smoking on airplanes? Imagine that. How could there be smoking on airplanes? Yeah, and just everybody can, everybody who's there, remember. So here is evidence to action. I testified before the House Subcommittee on Aviation in 1987, and I remember that it was said that how could people would not obey if there was an in-flight smoking ban. Pilots would not be able to fly. Probably planes would come crashing down because of lack of concentration. Now if you smoke, you're arrested. Now, some years ago, Tom Burke and I at Tom at Hopkins wrote a paper on the strategy of Dow creation around secondhand smoke. And I just will point out to you that it sort of goes through the whole set of possibilities. And in a way, it's sort of epi one upside down. We say, think about confounding and selection bias and other forms of bias. And what does the industry say? They say these biases are unavoidable, uncontrollable, and all epidemiology is flawed. That's, ever heard that? That's Dow creation. Attack epidemiology, weak, soft science. Can't really answer questions. They don't do RCTs for things like to smoke and kill people. Imagine that. Methodological problems. Doing counter, what I call counter science, their own studies. Hiring critics, still done. Creating scientific societies and journals, even that happened in the indoor air quality world. And then, of course, harassing researchers, a tactic that is still playing out, not just by the tobacco industry, in fact, but by others. So these are tactics. And if you want more, here's a selection of books. There are many more, but you start with one, and then perhaps the Oreskes and Conway. If you don't want to read a book, there's even a documentary. There's a movie. Okay, and it's a great movie. It starts with Stan Glantz from UCSF, a longtime tobacco control person, and it's a good watch. Now, so that's doubt. But what I want to switch to, and I hope you'll see the contrast, is this idea that belief is equal to or can outweigh evidence. So I'm not saying doubt is undermining the evidence, but the switch here is that something else is going on that I think is very important to our field, belief being at least equal to evidence. You know, like as said by the dude, I hope you know who the dude is, and if not, then you have to go watch The Big Lebowski. Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion. I guess it should be man or woman, but he's the dude. There are, again, books that you might turn to. I was on a panel recently with Tom Nichols, and he's written about this, The Death of Expertise, the campaign against established knowledge and why it matters. So some examples that you know and can easily think of, childhood vaccination and autism, climate change, evolution at times, genetically modified organisms, electromagnetic radiation from cell phones. And this is not a matter necessarily of knowledge. This is the state of California, where it was possible to get a personal exemption for children from vaccination until the law was changed because so many people had obtained that exemption. And this is a map of the state. And for those of you who know the state of California, those areas with the most affluent, most educated people, in fact, tended to have the highest rates of non-vaccination. So this wasn't a question of necessarily evidence, but just that underlying belief somehow that these vaccinations were harmful. So as described by Nichols, this death of expertise is a rejection of science and dispassionate rationality. At least if you go back to the founding fathers of the United States, they believed in science and reason. Some of them were citizen scientists themselves. Think about Franklin or Jefferson, just as easy examples. So an expert, by virtue of being an expert, becomes somebody not to be listened to. So, and in our political system, and this last is important, that equal rights may mean that opinion of everyone holds equal weight, and opinion is viewed as balancing or equivalent to evidence. So what has happened? Our science has become politicized. Climate change, for example, we'll see. Many lament a decline of scientific literacy and numeracy. Fake news, fake science disseminated quickly and widely. The devaluation of experts and expertise, and what I'll call a high-level dissing of science, and we'll come to a personal example. You might put on your reading list this book by Sean Otto, though about 2 years out now, The War on Science, which goes through things, this situation in great detail. He's right, science is political. We get evidence, we judge it. Science creates knowledge. Knowledge is power, and that power is political. And it's the power, I think, that leads to this path of backlash, again, distinct from the creation of doubt by stakeholders whose interests may be affected by science. Here's a graph. It shows the probability of respondents saying there's solid evidence of recent global warming due mostly to human activity by level of scientific, quote, intelligence as gauged by some indices. And you can see that as people become perhaps more science literate, they split by party, by political belief. This is the politicization, said that without stumbling, of science, okay, a concern. Public confidence in scientists has remained stable for decades at 40%. Okay, what about the other 60%? Why aren't we credible? So I guess it's good news that we're not sinking, but we are not going up. And overlying this, and I think this will not be news to many, is that we have frames by which we look at evidence, by which we look at science, by which we bring our prior beliefs. And this is some thoughts from Kahn, who's really drawing on the work of Kahneman and Tversky here around the framing of our beliefs and judgments based in part on who we are. And here's a plot based giving four quadrants of where we stand personally on hierarchy and egalitarianism and individualism and belief in what's called communitarianism over here on the plot. And you can think about which quadrant you are in, but you can see, for example, gun control as high risk in that top left column and low risk in that bottom right column. Okay, you can see that the point here is that how we frame actions in public health and elsewhere depends on our background belief system. So this is about belief, and of course this will set how we view evidence, not coming necessarily from a neutral stance. So hence, said this, only coal miners in West Virginia would believe that Trump is actually going to put the miners back to work, or having guns in schools is likely to save lives. Again, these are different quadrants. Now, this comes into our politics. Paul Braun, congressman from Georgia, in fact, is on the House Science Committee. You can see here's his views of what he learned in medical school. Give you a moment to read that. House Science Committee member. Now, I talked about the role of the high-level dissing of science, and I think in terms of us as experts, epidemiologists, translating our information, we have new ground. Thank God, a panel of experts. I will say I have to credit Leon Gordas, my longtime predecessor at Hopkins, for this cartoon, which is multi-used by me because of this issue of experts and expert judgment and our role in taking action in government and non-governmental sectors. This high-level dissing is a challenge. I'll highlight something here in a moment. I've testified here before the House Science Committee on work I've done at the National Academy of Sciences on looking at assessment of the risks of chemicals. The hearing is actually chaired by Congressman Brown. The full committee chair, Congressman Hall, walks into the hearing room as the hearing is winding down, and here's the exchange. Chairman Brown, now recognize the full committee chairman, Mr. Hall, for 5 minutes. Chairman Hall, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In as much as I don't know what questions have been asked or answers elicited, and as much as I probably wouldn't believe anything any of the three of you say, I yield back my time. I call this high-level dissing of science. I was a little bit stunned by this. I was there with Paul Anastas, a pioneering green chemist and the head of research and development at EPA, and someone high up from the government accounting office. But notice the word believe appears. Okay, believe. So, and this is key, and I'm just going to whine a minute more about being attacked by Senator Imhoff over my work as chair of the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee and how I must come with background beliefs, and that's stated in here. I'm afraid I'm probably the poster child for those who will no longer be appointed to the Science Advisory Board committees of the EPA. So what are we going to do in this sort of post-evidence era? So back to Jefferson for a moment. This is a great quote about the need to have people be informed and the relationship of the success of our government. Otto has some ideas. I will say number one is do something. And he covers a number of different issues. Oops, sorry for the numbering, which seems to have slipped here. It's interesting, this preaching in the age of science, I just actually came from a meeting at the Vatican that was on climate change and air pollution. And there are two representatives of evangelical organizations there who work on bringing the climate change issue to the fore in evangelical congregations. Scientific code of ethics, that might be useful on this belief and doubt issue, for example. Bringing science into the discussion of elections would be important. I highlighted scientists need to fight back. We need to find our voice. So if you take number one, do something, and number 12, fight back, then the question will be, how is that done? And I think that's where we are all challenged. Our professional societies may opine on particular things. We may march. I suspect many of you were at the March for Science. And we may write. But whether we can reach is hard to know. This is a piece I had in the New England Journal in March. My co-authors, Tom Burke, head of research and development in the Obama administration, Bernie Goldstein, former dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health, had the same position in the Reagan administration. Okay? And we wrote here about the need to stay with the science. One quote, scientific evidence does not change when the administration changes. Certainly the handling of it may, as many of you know, or perhaps we all know, but generating strong scientific evidence is something we all need to continue doing, assuring it's communicated properly, we need to do, and standing up and assuring that it is treated the way it should be is also something we need to do. You may or may, who knows who Philip K. Dick is? So he's a science fiction writer who, among other things, wrote what became Blade Runner. If you don't know, he's some of the many, many little pithy things, but strange how paranoia can link up with reality now and then. And, you know, if you start getting a little paranoid, you know, just think about where some of the drive for belief, the current stance on evidence might come from. How many stakeholders are having their interests affected by scientific evidence? So is this manufactured? Why are there players? Is there a deep conspiracy? I'm not a conspiracy theorist necessarily, but I think given what we've seen in the past with doubt, I think we should pay some attention to what's going on and its origins. So implications for us, for those of us who do epidemiology, is the death of evidence universal? Is it an epidemic? Might be. What are the implications of the dismissal of scientific evidence by the U.S. for epidemiologists? Are there global forces? And what can we do to preserve the use of epidemiological evidence for advancing public health? I think our science is particularly vulnerable. I think it's particularly vulnerable for its power, for the issues that we touch on, and for Sometimes it's vulnerability to attacks for claims of uncertainty, failing to adjust for the nth confounder, perhaps not using the latest marginal structural model or whatever else may be coming along. We'll have to tell. Perhaps those tools will help us strengthen our case and being able to better tell the story about what it is we've learned. So are we at high risk? And I think the answer has to be clearly yes, we probably are. So I'm going to give you a few reading assignments. Just so you know, there are things out there. There was a useful workshop that had many players at the National Academies in March. The workshop proceedings is available online. This would be a great primer, examining the mistrust of science. It's probably 12, 15 pages, so a worthy read. And there's an unreadable URL at the bottom. But I think you've got enough for Google to help you out. And there it is. And then just a large number of books. And this is only a few. For some reason, I've become a completionist on reading all these books. The message is getting a little repetitive and sometimes depressing. But I think, you know, we need to know the story if we want to assure that epidemiology continues to be important. So I'd like to end. I think we have a little bit of time left. Again, I want to thank you for this wonderful opportunity to speak with friends and colleagues. And if we do have time, Oscar, for discussion, let's do it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Sure. You're a pro at this, so I'll allow you to take your questions.
Never done this before.
Unmodeled.
Hi, I'm Ann Vanderstoop from the University of Washington. And as I heard your talk, I just happened to pick up maybe a month or so ago The People's History of the United States again by Howard Zinn, and I hadn't read it in a long time. And it just reminded me that whenever the people in power are threatened, they tell lies. And it's, you know, if you watch the history of the justification of slavery in this country, or the position of women, or the terrorism of indigenous peoples, it was always done through lies that looked like science and truth. And it's carried on, perpetuated. So I'll have to say just a little thing that I went to the inauguration this year with my daughters, and we stood with our, or we knelt, I guess, on the ground with our backs to the podium as Trump was being, inaugurated. And my daughter stood up and said, "Mom, this is the death of the patriarchy." Mm-hmm. I don't know, there's this paradox in that it's always been this way. We all do have to work to stand up to it. This time may not be any different, but maybe we know more about how it all works, and maybe we're able more effectively to speak truth to power through what we're going through now.
So it's been a long time since I read that book. You know, as a comment, I said this is not about Trump at the start, because it's playing out perhaps in the most open and fierce way with this administration, but this change and this view of evidence and expertise antedates the administration. And I think that's important, and it's not just top-down, and now we have sort of bottoms-up. And I think that makes for fertile ground for whatever top-down may do. So I appreciate your comments, but I think we have to think of something that unfortunately is now multi-level and has a base with belief of many, 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 many people. I think it's in the back. And then colleague from Michigan.
So, my very, very first public health class was an undergraduate at Hopkins, and it was 1994. And the chair of epidemiology walked in the room, and I think this was our first big public health class that we offered at the undergraduate campus. And he asked the whole room, "What's epidemiology?" And I stumbled into public health. I'd actually never heard. I came pre-med, and And he said, what's epidemiology? And somebody raised their hand and said, the study of the skin. Reluctantly, right? And then he said, well, maybe that would be epidermiology, sort of dermatology. So, but you asked how many people think that would ever, like half the room raised their hand, half of us were sort of that time. And it was you. You were my first public health professor. And I'm not calling you Bernie Sanders, but the if you look at Bernie Sanders and who he was and the things he spoke about, you know, in the 70s, like, he's growing, but his, like, who he is fundamentally and at his core has been very constant and consistent. You always knew who he was. And it is so beyond awesome to hear you now, like, in a sort of in your own evolution. I mean, you were the chair of EPI, which makes you like a demigod student at Hopkins, but I'm just so like honored and moved. I'm back here like telling everybody, that was my first public health professor. So just on behalf of all of the students and all of the graduate students and all of the junior faculty that you've made just such a profound difference for, I couldn't be more honored to like acknowledge you as the guy who sparked the flame for me and many others.
That's really nice. Yeah, I will say, and I'm sure I'm speaking for Noel when I say this, probably one of the most gratifying things when you get senior, if you will, in your career is seeing all the people you've trained and how much they've accomplished. So Tiffany's here, and you know, I will say that I've delighted to hear your remarks. I'm glad there was somebody there listening. Thanks, Robin.
Question is around developing better collaborations with basic science, the bench scientists, you know, animal studies and cell-based studies, and really working more as teams in terms of really trying to elucidate the inner workings of the black box. And what
so,
you think about
yeah,
that?
So I'll come in. I mean, clearly there are questions that are demanding in the evidence that needs to be mounted to answer them. The evidence may come from observations on people, observations on chemicals within people, DNA, gene activation, so many things. And I think that it's better for all disciplines of science if when we approach a problem we can tell a story together. I will say, and I'll point to Tyler and his colleagues, one thing we really need are tools that allow us to bring these different lines of evidence together and to join them. And I have to say, I've been on committees going back 30 years where, for example, we talked about using Bayesian methods to bring together the laboratory and the population. And, you know, 30 years later, I'm still saying we need better methods to bring together the laboratory and the population. But I hope the kind of work you and others are doing will help us achieve that. I think it's a key issue. Yes.
So, fabulous lecture. Thank you very much for that. And this is a totally global phenomenon. This is UK-wide. This has been a big problem. And I was interested in your rallying fight back. And I was trying to think, one of the things that's been possibly the most successful in the scientific fight back in the UK has been to put science as percentage of the economy, because that's all we talk about, obviously, in the Brexit era. And the other is to say how good we are at it, and wouldn't it be terrible if we were less good at it, so we're cutting edge. So the kind of writing which the public can understand are those two things, which is to say, my goodness, we're at the cutting edge of science and we should be proud of it. This is amazing. We're really good at it. We're good at putting groups, teams from different groups of science together and coming up with solutions. So there's been quite a bit of writing about that, and the other has been about the economy, which is to say, what would happen if all our wonderful scientists left? Yeah. What would we be left with? So those two arguments kind of play into the narrative that's happening in the UK now, and they really hit opinion formers who are not scientists. So one of the things we always think about in the public's health at RSPH is about getting people on side who are not the usual suspects and who are not in our territory and camp. And using some of those ways of doing it has been kind of how I think the response has been from the scientific community in the UK.
So I think a quick comment, and then I think we're done. And you know, of course, you're right. We need many many strategies. I was briefly at the career session before this, and I was gratified to see so many young people, so many sort of first timers here at the session. That said, I think we do need to do a better job of telling our story to those who need to hear it. And epidemiologists may be particularly poor storytellers. We use big words. We use words like confounding. I mean, really. I mean, if you walked up to somebody in the public and said, "What's a confounder? Forget about what's epidemiology." I mean, what are they gonna say? So I think we need to tell our story better publicly and to the decision makers. And you know, of course, the work we do has enormous economic implications, which I think is why, in fact, there's often so much pushback. Food, tobacco, you know, air pollution. I mean, it's just, the list goes on and on and on. I don't think there's been enough systematic discussion about what to do. Perhaps your society, others, this one really need to take the lead. But I can see time is up. Thank you so much.
Well, okay. I just have one follow-up to that, because I teach health equity students, and so they're students who are really passionate about, and they want to, you know, be activists, and they're across the School of Public Health, and they're in all disciplines. And you know, when you're talking about fighting back and how do we train them, what's the next step with them? So, you know, they want to write op-eds, they want to, you know, do things on social media. How can we, you know, provide those opportunities for them inside the academy? Or is it, you know, telling them to fight for policy? What direction should I be taking them in?
If I had hours we could organize a meeting to but I do think, you know, talking to ourselves is not enough. And I think, you know, I'll leave it at that. We need to think about what are the channels to reach out. You know, it's like the paper I had in the New England Journal. All my friends wrote and said, "Well, great paper." That's exactly what I would have said. Do I think Scott Pruitt read it? I doubt it. I mean, maybe it was in, you know, EPA attacked in the Daily Bulletin, but I do think this is something we exactly what you said, to help all of us really do a better job of reaching out. And again, I think this should be part of what schools of public health need to figure out as sort of another metric of the impact that we should be having.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. Thank you all. This concludes our career awards session. We do invite you to our social hour. We know you're competing with tons of other social hours, but we have a special one, and you will get an opportunity to spend some time with our awardees as well. I will ask our awardees, please come up to the front so we can take some group shots with the leadership of the section. And once again, thank you all for your due diligence and for being with us this evening.